evaluation findings and student performances from social studies education.
Is it easier for you if I speak up or if I use the mic? The mic? Okay.
Good morning. I'm in the lovely position of being able to speak about a program that is not my own, which makes me feel entirely free to tell you how wonderful it is. I'm here to talk about Scenarios USA. It's a nonprofit organization that's carried out an evaluation on which I collaborated of a highly innovative approach to sex education. Focused on the question, what's the real deal about masculinity? I have no financial disclosures. I work with the Population Council, a nonprofit research organization that collaborated on the evaluation. The 5 points that I'm going to cover in my talk are, first of all, why do we need a new approach? What's missing? And a look at the evidence. What is Scenarios USA? How do they turn the sex ed paradigm on its head? How do we design and what did we learn from a 2007 evaluation? Final discussion and conclusion, and share with you some concrete resources that I've brought. Carlos talked about goals, both the kind of public health goals as well as the sexual health and sort of the sexual rights and goals. And so I would just say that scenarios, looking at the goals, it's both to create the conditions that will enable young people to enjoy sexual health and satisfaction, the dignity, equality, and sexual life characterized by personal satisfaction, as well as the public health goals related to HIV, STIs, pregnancy, and violence. So first of all, we spent a lot of time defending comprehensive sex education. But in fact, I would argue that in doing that, and because we've been so in the trenches defending that, that we really haven't been entirely honest with ourselves about asking how effective such programs are. We've been defending them against the abstinence-only programs. But I would argue that, in fact, I had a reversion. I don't have any of the original font, so I'm not sure how the format for the OMB on this. But if we look at the comprehensive reviews of sex education that have been done in both developing countries and developed countries by Doug Kirby and his colleagues, we see that they have some effect on what students report as their behavior. They have almost no effect on health outcomes. Now, how many of us really recognize that and take it in, that 80% have no or negative impact on STIs? And an almost equal number, 77% of programs have no or negative impact on pregnancy rates. I'll go back for 1 minute. I'll even mention that what we recognize is that there's probably a lot of positive bias as well. First of all, there's self-reporting by students who have gone through sex education programs, who know what they're, quote, supposed to say. It's one form of positive bias. Also, the programs that are strong enough to be rigorously evaluated are probably, on the average, better programs, more thoughtful and comprehensive programs than the ones that we don't read studies about. So if anything, these represent a positive bias. Okay. Well, what do we know about what were the reasons that might be happening? And we would argue that a key gap in the content of sex education is attention to the gender norms that actually drive young people's sexual decisions, attitudes, and behavior. That, in fact, study after study has shown us that young people who adhere to more traditional or conservative values related to gender have worse sexual health outcomes than their peers. They're more likely to experience a range of problems, and let's just look at some of the examples. And I just want to say this is a fundamental point that our entire field has ignored at its peril. Here are just some of the outcomes that are associated the risk of adhering to more among those kids who have more traditional norms. And I'll just let you look at them. Across the board, contraceptive use, HIV rates, violence within intimate relationships, etc. So when we look at the curricula that we have, the ones we're busy defending, and Carlos very well gave us a spectrum from the most abstinence-only oriented toward the sexual rights spectrum, okay? Somewhere in the middle there, or toward the sexual rights spectrum, but not all the way, are the curricula that are considered to be sort of the classics, this, you know, the gold standard for our field. But if in fact we ask how well do they address gender, at the Population Council we did an fairly informal preliminary review of about 24 of the most widely used and cited curricula. And in general, they emphasize technical information and highly individualistic models of decision, like a young person who can just kind of think about their own values and go out and then act on them. That gender and rights receive little or no attention. Again, there's very little attention to fostering the kind of critical thinking skills that we know cognitively are required for people to begin to shift their frame on issues like gender. That classroom dynamics also tend to often reinforce traditional gender norms. And there was a really interesting study by Jessica Fields of programs that are, whether it's absence-only programs or sort of liberal comprehensive sex ed, that the teachers themselves in the classroom dynamics often reinforce sexist or homophobic notions, even as the, quote, content that they're delivering isn't intending to do that. We also know that gender norms are mutable and that programs that are working specifically to change gender norms have shown outcomes in terms of change attitudes and behaviors. They look at gender as basically what some researchers are now calling a gateway factor to sexual health outcomes, and reproductive health outcomes. You can probably imagine some of the kinds of examples that traditional comprehensive sex education is not going to address. I mean, in Southern California communities that have, and I'm sure not only Southern California, gangs, for example, one of the young teenage boys join gangs is because they don't feel safe and because they have to prove their manhood. Then you get in the gang and you find out you're not safe. You're going to end up jail or dead or at constant risk. And if you end up in jail, you can't get out of the gang in jail. So there's only really one way that young men get a pass out of the gang. And what would that be? Right, fatherhood. So either with the support of his girlfriend who wants him out of the gang, or without his girlfriend or some girl knowing what's going on, he gets a girl pregnant. He gets out of the gang. The gang goes on fine. He goes on fine. The girls, at least in Southern California, in that situation, are dropping out of school and left with the baby. The boy stays with the girl, doesn't stay with the girl. A million scenarios, as you know. The classic sex education curricula. We know that none of the information in there is really going to make a difference for her about using a condom or knowing the symptoms and risk of sexually transmitted infection. And there are many such scenarios that we could go into. If you think about what's sort of been considered kind of an epidemic of middle school girls across class in this country giving boys oral sex, you know, there's nothing in the standard curricula that help kids understand that this is sort of a service industry. So, again, it's just kind of a couple of examples. So Scenarios USA, which works in four regions of this country, South Texas by the border, New York City, Cleveland, and in Florida. What they do is they have a curriculum that seeks to engage students to think critically, to analyze their social context, particularly related to gender and intimate relationships, to develop their own voice, and this is something in working with them I've come to appreciate is a really important, powerful, and critical part of their program, and generally to feel more connected to school. The key variable in studies looking at the experts who look at what school dropout rates, which, as you know, in this country, in inner cities, are astronomical, particularly for boys, often as low as few as 20-30% of African-American boys in some cities are graduating from high school. And the key variable for keeping kids in school is connectedness to teachers and schools. So that's another one of their explicit goals. Anyway, they turned the whole paradigm on its head and thought, okay, we're going to zero base think. We're not going to start from the frame of what information we've been thinking we have to put out there. And they just really said, okay, what do kids need to learn? And they developed this program, and I'll just kind of quickly walk you through it. They frame it around the question, what's the real deal? They had started off looking at traditional sex ed topics like HIV or teen pregnancy, and they've shifted, as I said, to more explicitly addressing the underlying factors. So now it's the current one is, what's the real deal about masculinity? They give teachers a workshop. They do a they have a curriculum, which I have a copy of. I can show you a teacher's guide. They have films, which I'll get to in a minute. The kids, a lot of the activities have a lot of writing. It's a very writing-based program and a lot of journaling, of personal writing, narrative writing by the kids. And if any of you are interested in that, it's really a growing, important field. And there's a study by Pennebaker that looks at the impact on mental health of young people just to be writing their feelings. And then the end, they turn their writing, they pick their best writing, they turn it into a script, they fictionalize it, turn it into a script, and submit it to scenarios. Scenarios, I get maybe 1,000 of these scripts. They have a process to reduce it and pick the top 3 scripts, one from each region. And then they pair the winning authors with very well-known Hollywood directors who volunteer their time, go to that kid's town and work with them, and they audition local kids, and they produce the most awesome 10, 20-minute short films that are entirely authentic but have incredible production value. They're downloadable on their site, and you can see them. I don't know if they're downloadable, but they're viewable on their site, and you can also buy them. So as I said, the current theme is, what's the real deal about masculinity? This came out of their own experience of moving closer to see what was really shaping the decisions of these kids. Here's some of the subtopics that are the kind of the core, so you get a sense of what they mean when they ask that question. What's masculinity? Question about fatherhood, for example, one might be about masculinity. For example, one assignment is to think of a man that you admire as a man and go interview him and ask him what manhood means to him. With fatherhood, one of the activities is to write a letter that starts out, "Dear Dad, you think I forgot, but I remember." And it could be anything. And again, in Cleveland, which was one of the cities, the city where most of the evaluation took place, 80% of the kids are living in a home where the father isn't present. That topic opens up a lot of their thinking and questions about masculinity. A unit on sexuality, on violence, and then finally beginning to develop their writing skills. So they just piloted this masculinity curriculum this year, and it involves evaluation, survey, classroom observations, in-depth interviews with students and teachers, and an analysis of how the scripts that were submitted, the 1,000 scripts that were submitted, looked at gender issues, and particularly not like politically correct answers, but what was the intent or even the skill in writing, but what was the intent of these young authors to raise questions about gender, as opposed to previous year's scripts where they didn't have such an explicit gender focus. Okay, so those different methodologies, the survey wanted to look primarily at attitudes change regarding masculinity, which I said is a kind of a gateway factor. Confidence, students' confidence in their voice as writers and their connectedness to school. A survey was done with about 500 plus students, plus an equal number of controls at baseline and inline. A second method was observations of the classroom by an ethnographer, looking particularly at those items that are bold at the bottom: listening and dialogue skills, personal reflection and critical thinking, content of remarks about gender, and overall level of engagement in the classroom. As compared to the observer went first to see a classroom of that section by the teacher before the curriculum was done, and then visited 2 separate sessions during the curriculum. And there was a tested form for this, et cetera. Student and teacher interviews, which were in-depth interviews about some of the same questions. Those were done in all cities, not just in Cleveland. And the content analysis of scripts. This was basically taking 100 randomly chosen scripts from this cycle on masculinity and 200 randomly chosen ones from the previous several years, shuffling them together, then having somebody who doesn't know what scenarios is or what the thing was use a form that had been developed and tested to basically assess these kids' intent, as I said, about how meaningfully they were trying to question and grapple with these questions, and then reshuffling and sorting. Okay, what were the findings? First of all, the survey found the most consistent changes among younger-aged girls, females. They were disaggregated by gender, race, type of school. And so there was 13 to 15-year-olds and 16 to 18-year-olds. And the most consistent changes were among girls, particularly those 13 to 15. There were 2 pre-existing masculinity scales that were incorporated into the survey. They ask questions like, I think I can give you a couple examples. I admire a guy who can back down from a fight. I would be friends with someone who's gay, that kind of thing. The questions about communication skills had things like, I think that the stories I have to tell are meaningful. I think I'm pretty good at getting in dialogues with people that I disagree with, but I can do it respectfully. The wording is close to that, but I'm not reading the question. The communication skills was another zone that showed changes. Older boys did not show changes in the survey, but were really kind of a little bit stymied methodologically about what happened here. It was a third local partner in Cleveland who'd carried out the survey. Both the observers, the teachers, and the person who did the data analysis that looked at comments said these kids didn't take the survey seriously. They could read it in various ways, the kind of jokes they made, and the people who observed it, some of the teachers who observed it. And we weren't, the scenarios, and neither the council was actually directly involved, so we may actually just repeat the survey. But we're not sure how much it's reflecting what happened or not. So in any case, with girls who are younger, there seems to have been a demonstrable change, but we don't know, we're not rock solid on the rest of it. The classroom observations, which were extensive, did show differences in all four domains, in some cases just dramatic. Listening and dialogue skills, as I said, these four areas, personal reflection, critical thinking, this is compared to the previously sat in control class sessions. Level of engagement. And I want to talk a little more about the last one, which is that kids' comments about gender issues and including how they link to sexuality and sexual health. So here's just a few examples of the kinds of comments that kids would make in terms of exploring masculinity. The last one here with the three comments is more, and the one under that, to show the ethnographer who did the observations was particularly interested that in the non-control sessions, in the scenarios discussion groups, kids listened to each other, they made eye contact, listened to each other, and responded to what somebody else said, which was just not going on in the previous sessions. So people had all kinds of comments all over the map, but what was happening is that it provided teachable moments. They would bring them to the fore, someone would disagree, they would respond. Here's some other ones. The questions in green were questions that the teacher would usually raise, although sometimes the students would raise them. So you can see that people are disagreeing, but they're actually interacting with each other. The last question about what makes a good father was something teachers also brought up, that the teachers would say, you know, the young men say, oh, she should have got knocked up by one of the guys in the, you know, who deals, because then she'd have someone pay for the baby. There was a real sense that fathers should be providing for their children. Kids felt this so strongly, even as they negotiated and feeling the fact that their fathers, many of them were not providing for them. It was a very strong feeling. And for young men growing up in the ghetto, one of the very few avenues they have to do that is through drugs. And so this was something they were negotiating a lot, whether the drug dealer father was the role model for masculinity that they could admire or not. And basically it summed up, though, when they asked the question, what makes a real man? The answer that one girl said, well, we know now, it's society. So that was the observations. The interviews, basically, I won't go into a lot of detail, but the interviews with the teachers basically corroborated this. You can just have a look. As I said, boys are struggling with these issues. And a couple of teachers reported particularly this issue of greater connection was so powerful. This is something that scenarios teachers had mentioned in previous years too, so we wanted to look at it. I, for one, became really much more sensitized and aware of how important that was. That, you know, one teacher said, I'm the kind of teacher nobody comes to. They don't like me, you know, I'm a different race, I'm older, I'm da da, you know. And she said the number of kids who started coming to her was with personal issues just astonished her. It turned her around as a teacher and her identity. She gave a couple of examples related to sexual health. Both girls were pregnant, actually. One was in an early pregnancy, told her how she was feeling, and she said, that sounds like you might have an ectopic pregnancy. You're leaving school right now, and you're going to get a test. And she told her where to go. And this girl had an ectopic pregnancy, and as you know, she could have easily burst her tube. The other girl was an advanced pregnancy. In Cleveland, the pregnant girls tend to stay in school, many of them, not all. and she was had bloated. She didn't want to do something because her feet hurt, her legs hurt, and were swollen. And she looked at her and she said, "You're going right now, too." And she sent her, and that girl had toxemia. She could have been dead within 12 hours. And these are girls who came to her, a teacher that they never go to, who's really, in a sense, she said, I feel like I'm saving lives, because before I couldn't even reach my kids. So there are many examples of this issue of teachers reporting tremendous personal satisfaction from this sense of connectedness to kids. The student interviews are still being analyzed. I'm not going to report on them. The content analysis skills, I have just a partial. This was blank because I was hoping the data was going to come to me before I finished the presentation. The person who was going to report on this is in the hospital. A person who didn't know scenarios, as I said, did all the analysis of these scripts and handed it back to be recoded so that we could see which one were from this year. That was starting to happen, and they were clearly showing a difference that the ones from this year, not surprisingly, when you have a topic like masculinity, was actually more thoughtfully questioning these gender norms. But she didn't get through it, and she wasn't able to analyze for any kind of statistical significance in the difference, so it's just at this point that preliminary analysis. So some of what Scenarios has learned from this is that the topic itself is one that got the teachers, the school district people, the mayor, everybody so excited, the kids as well. The manner in which the curriculum is delivered is very flexible and varied a lot, which makes it difficult in terms of a standardized evaluation, but actually makes it very friendly for a teacher. They can pick what they want from it. And that there are significant changes in attitudes reported as a result of the curriculum. Qualitatively, we'd say across the board, and quantitatively at this point we can only say among females who are younger, an age group that's actually most critical to reach. I want to reinforce the fact that young people's attitudes about sexuality being shaped by gender issues, this study really reconfirmed in every way the centrality of that. And also that their experience of gender is so profoundly shaped by other aspects of social context. So what masculinity means and what it means to try to perform it, for example, in inner city Cleveland versus in Seattle or in a rural community is obviously tremendously different. We need to develop and test a wide range of approaches. We need to, in many ways, I'd say, leave the old sex ed paradigm behind curricula in terms of our goals and our learning objectives and the curriculum that we think about. We have to stop kind of inching away and worrying about abstinence only versus more information on contraception and just sort of think fresh about helping change kids' frame of mind and thinking. Need to place issues like gender and equality at the heart of sex and HIV education. And in fact, that's exactly what, as Carlos said, PAHO and World Association of Sexual Health are now suggesting happen. And PAHO and WASC just organized a meeting at the last AIDS conference in which all the ministers of education and or health were present and issued a declaration that they're going to roll out sex education across the region. And the documents, like the declaration that Carlos mentioned, are giving policy muscle to roll it out in this different kind of way. So I want to just quickly tell you about a couple of key resources that would be, I think, useful to anybody who wants to kind of think about leaving the old paradigm behind. And although this evaluation is just one piece of it and has only limited findings at this point, there are other, as I mentioned earlier, programs around the world that are looking explicitly trying to change gender norms for sexual health outcomes, and there is a growing literature showing that it can be effective, and I would argue probably more effective than the anemic effects I showed you at the beginning of what we have now. So the first one I want to tell you about is, do you have that or do I have that curriculum? I think I must have. The curriculum. Scenarios. They have a teacher's guide that is for sale on what's the real deal about masculinity. And they have also, I mentioned they produce films. So you can buy any of their films, and the three films that have been made out of this masculinity writing contest are just finishing their final cut. They're going to have their premiere in New York in early December. And so those are being available. I've only seen them in rough cut. You should just check out their films, guys. If you go to their website, which is scenariosusa.org. Go to watch films. I think the last year's film, the one I liked, is called Reflections. It just talks about HIV. It's an example. These are made by directors whose films you've seen. So they have this. They're just finishing revising the discussion guide coming out of the pilot year, and the three films as well. So that'll be available to you. And the other thing is, if I have a limited number of packets that tell you about scenarios. So if you want to, three other films were shown yesterday here. Another one's going to be shown at room 111, I think it is, where the films are being shown over at the convention center just after our workshop today. So these are mostly for me to hand out there. But if you'd like to come and pick one up, you really want one, then you can. Otherwise, you can get the information on their website. The other resource I want to tell you about, and that maybe Eric can just pass out. Thanks. Sorry. Is something called Heart of the Matter. It's a resource kit that's coming out in a few months that integrates gender. It enables educators to integrate gender and rights into their sex or HIV curriculum. So it's not just kind of, oh, here's a sort of creative program for developing scripts and personal reflection. It's actually more for school districts and education ministries or whatever, teachers, principals who, or health center people who are really looking to integrate. What does it mean to be gender sensitive? What does it mean to be rights-based? And has units, so these are guidelines, basically, for creating or adapting your own curricula. But it's more than just, it has all the information there, but it also provides some guidelines around teaching approaches. It provides a summary of some of the evidence that I gave you earlier about the links between gender and sexual health outcomes. It provides the evidence-based rationale for this approach in a summary. And it gives you 60 sample activities along with each of the topics and lists of other resources. That's going to be available. It was created by International Planned Parenthood together with the Population Council and a number of other organizations, both U.S., international, and other country, I mean, international organizations and countries, other country organizations. So I wanted you to know about Heart of the Matter as well. It'll be available, and I think it's going to be at no cost to any nonprofit or government. In fact, it will be. So that's the end of what I wanted to go through. We're right on time. Yeah, so we can take questions.
Thank you,
but I did want to interface it.
Questions for our presenters?
I'd actually like to ask a question. How many of you are involved with programs that are doing sex education at some level? Can you tell us a little bit about it? Can people hear?
And part of our funding comes through Title X money, which calls for us to be outreach and education. Because we get a lot of teens that come into our
I'd be interested to know your comments about the balance of information versus sort of personal reflection and teaching kind of that kind of skill of thinking critically and how that could be. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about sort of the spectrum of approaches that Carlos mentioned or is in a similar way that I presented about emphasis on kind of clinical information or kind of just individual models or notions of how people make decisions versus looking at kind of a broader social context or personal reflection about kind of self and society, you know, just looking at all the social forces that drive young people's sexual experience, given that population.
Pregnant, you know, when they got an STD. we participate in schools and to try to get develop policies around comprehensive sexuality education. And we have involved teams in that process because teams reach out to us that they need information. So we don't support.
So, I don't know, maybe other people have comments, but I just would be, you raise an important dilemma, I think, which is, of course, everybody needs basic information about their bodies, and that's just technical information that they need. But whether the information alone is going to enable people to protect their health, like the example I was giving of, I'm going to ask you if you could just pass this around while we do this. If people, if you can just, scenarios ask me to have people sign up.
Why don't we leave this up here afterwards?
Okay, that's fine. Maybe you could put it by the back with a pen. That would be fine. The example I was giving also, what you said reminded me, the example of middle-aged girls, middle school girls, giving oral sex to boys at parties, even at school, whatever. And whether any information they have, just sort of information about their, you know, is going to change that dynamic. Because it's going on also apparently among kids going through sex ed programs. Or to what extent, what else do they need? Because you mentioned about abstinence, and in fact, with some of the work that the Population Council is doing is sort of arguing that we'd promote, that we would have a lot more abstinence if girls were thinking about sex as something that was for them and not for the boy. That if they could understand that if they're not getting pleasure from it, it's actually not sex. They're just complicit in their own abuse. And trying to reframe the way that girls think about that experience could probably lead to a lot less sex among young people, particularly, you know, younger kids. If they could, but that's not how girls think about it. And in fact, the reason that girls and boys cite for beginning to have sex is very different. Boys tend to cite, as you can probably imagine, curiosity and pleasure, which are actually really good reasons, at least among the good reasons. And girls tend to cite looking to strengthen a relationship, which is a really bad reason because it leads them to having sex for some other means that's not about the sex, and doesn't actually necessarily strengthen a relationship either, so particularly at that age. So I think that looking at some of those kinds of issues with young kids in a way that's developmentally appropriate, I think is sort of critical. Yeah?
I've got a question. It might take us a little bit away from the global aspect, but it's a question about some of the measures that you use, specifically about attitudes, since that was kind of a positive finding from this evaluation. You look like you looked at two types of attitudes. Can you restate those again?
We actually looked at, I have a copy of the survey here. We looked at attitudes toward masculinity using two scales, one that was developed by Pleck, it's called the MRAS, and the other that was developed by Deb Tolman and Chu, I can't remember Chu's first name, called the AMIRS, A-M-I-R-S scale. Partly we were interested to see if they were consistent with each other. The AMIRS scale turned out to be way superior and more consistent, I think more appropriate. But that was looking at attitudes toward masculinity. There were 8 and 12 questions respectively. We looked at ability to, sense of confidence in one's voice and sense of connectedness to school. Sense of connectedness to school, I don't think the question that was used, we used one of the questions, for example, was how many trusted adults are in your life? Trying to see if teachers began to, or the other people, men that people would interview, et cetera, started to weigh in at all. We picked that question because it had been in a previous question that had been approved by the Cleveland School District, which had was a factor for us. But I don't think we saw a change in that.
But how did you look at changes? Did you look at scale changes or item changes?
We looked at both.
Okay,
we looked at both.
What were you reporting here?
The only place where we saw the significant was for the scale was in the younger girls. For some questions we saw as well. For other populations. Some of the, for example, issues about, I think it was violence and attitudes toward homosexuality, I think were the ones where we saw changes even for the older boys. But that was specific questions. And other changes had, like, no answer, and some even had negative answer, you know, so then mostly we're looking at the scale.
Did you do any psychometric assessments of the scales?
We didn't. In fact, the communication one, we couldn't call it a scale because it hadn't been pre-tested as a scale, so we had a set of questions. The masculinity scales have gone through different kinds of developmental testing, and we just sort of picked them up and made sure we were trying to use them in the right way, but I'm not an expert on their history of testing.
Development. Well, I was wondering, the reason I asked the question is because the Plex scale has been tested before, and it's been found to have kind of poor score reliability across populations.
So
it may not be adequately measuring masculinity like people think it might be, and that may be a reason you didn't find that.
Yeah, we found that it was not a useful scale also. I think the Amir scale has a couple of problems too, which is some of the questions say, I think, you know, I would, and other ones just say, a guy has to be such and such. And then you don't know if they're saying, I think the guy has to be, or I now know that society says the guy has to be. And so we didn't feel like we could retest the entire scale, and so we didn't monkey with the questions, but I think it's a problem. And when we look at the differences between questions and how they answered, we're not getting a clear answer on that. That's why I say there's a number of methodological issues for that. Maybe they'll redo the survey. I just want to ask people one thing, which is, you know, sometimes when we talk in a different kind of setting, one of the things we ask people, and I would ask you, if we all think back to a time in our own lives that we realized that gender really mattered to the way something was happening for us, the way somebody treated us. And, you know, maybe early in our life or at some, you know, even more recently. And, you know, I'm sure most of you, if you take a minute, can think of a time that gender affected an experience. You know, we felt how profoundly it shaped the way somebody treated us. And when you think about that, and then you think about how it felt, and it might have felt good, it might have felt, I mean, it could be all kinds of different ways. And then you think about a young person, and knowing that one of the domains of life in which gender, we take our attitude, you know, what the messages we've internalized about gender most intensely and concentrated is into sexual life. It seems almost like a screaming gap that it's basically absent from, and in any meaningful way, from what we call sex education.
Carlos, I was going to ask you a question about your experiences in Puerto Rico. I mean, I think in the United States, it varies state by state. Certainly Puerto Rico is probably the same way, but can you talk for a minute about the, what you've learned in your work about abstinence-only education in Puerto Rico and how that's being accepted or not so accepted? What are practitioners, people who are working in schools, how are they reacting to this type of approach?
I'm Carlos also, and Carlos is our student at the School of Public Health, and I would like to help with that answer. First, we also have some pilot plan funding at our School of Public Health, so we are in charge of administrating all the funding for Pilot 10 in Puerto Rico. However, the analysis and the experiment that you're asking is mostly oriented to the sex education program that we have at the school-based scenario. So I will say that, different to other states that ban the possibility of using abstinence-only education, in Puerto Rico, we are somehow promoting the use of that money. So for the last, I would say, 6 years, all the education that we have at the school level is abstinence-based. We have a lot of infrastructural issues. Like it was seen in the tables that Carlos showed, the Department of Health in Puerto Rico is the body that is administrating the money, but it's being implemented in the Department of Education. So to start with, at the administration level of funding, we have a great issue, because there is no link between the administration of the funding and the implementation. So that's why one of the achievements of doing this kind of analysis and generating the discussion is that finally, we, the School of Public Health, got involved in the evaluation of the abstinence-based education program. Because they've been funding for 6 years, they haven't performed any kind of evaluation. And we know that it's not working because the indicators that they're using that to start with, are not appropriate to reevaluate the sex ed patient, we know that it's not working. So now, starting actually in 1 month, we will be evaluating the retrospective information that we have for the last few years, and prospectively, we'll be evaluating the current. From the information we know, also, we have a curricula for sex ed education that is called to be comprehensive. However, because we have this funding for abstinence-based education, all the content that is included in the school health program that is sexuality education or STI prevention is not actually covered and is substituted by the abstinence-based education. So we also have some informal and non-official information about the experiences of teachers, and they are not feeling comfortable with the experience of educating based on abstinence. And what else? I think they're looking forward to evaluate the program, to have evidence that it's not working. We are in this political turmoil too in Puerto Rico, so we'll see what's going on in the next few months. And I'm just glad that we have the chance to evaluate the program finally, because they've been receiving a lot of money just to promote sex education, and we know that it's not appropriate. This kind of presentation has been very useful at the local level, because there is a lot of people that thinks that because that's where the money is, that's what will be proved that is working, you know. And for us, I think it's a role of the public health school to demonstrate how other experiences, how the policy can be changed based on the experiences that others are having and the information that we have of those goals that should be achieved through the sex education.
I'd be interested, aside from the two people who've spoken, to just hear from people about like what your own interest, how you got to this workshop, for example. I don't know if you could.
Used to be a sexual health educator. I was actually working in a clinic that would go to after school programs that for filling in the science class, and the teacher, you know, didn't feel comfortable doing the STI or working with these conditions. So I'm currently I make health education materials for campus. So those are interested to see what's going on in terms of new curriculum that's available. And this program actually sounds really interesting because I do think that gender, this critical examination of gender is lacking in public health education in general, or just public education rather, you know. And even I feel that starting at, you know, age 13 or 15, you have so many things happening even before that age that I almost feel that it could really be useful at a younger age to start examining, you know, why school is gender.
Yeah, in fact, I think not only can it be useful, but it can sometimes be less controversial than sex education. I mean, having to, you know, teachers, absent teachers, to create the political space to be able to talk about masturbation or abortion or homosexuality to younger kids is not only dicey, it's probably inappropriate. But talking about self and others and power relations between human beings, I think, is, you know, more of a social studies approach is, I think, ultimately less controversial, probably more subversive and far-reaching. I don't know if anybody else wants to say how you got to it.
I'm curious where your money came from to implement the program and to evaluate.
The Scenarios gets funding from Ford Foundation, the Gunn Foundation, the Cleveland Foundation. There's one other foundation in Cleveland that they were invited to Cleveland by, I think, the mayor and by a local community adolescent health coalition or consortium. So they were connected already. I can't remember everybody else they get their funding from. At the Population Council, the work that we do to enable us to collaborate with organizations in their evaluations and to work on developing this resource kit, for example, also comes from Ford Foundation and United Nations Population Fund, a little bit here and there, other places.
Well, we'll go ahead and close it if you want to ask some questions. Our presenters will be here to answer them for you. So thank you.
Thank you. If anybody wanted to see the curriculum briefly, here it is.
And there's the list up here, the attendance there, sign up.
Yeah,
and here.
People left. So I didn't think about it, and then she got sick, and I thought, oh, she'll get better, and then, like, really, she, you know, like, about a week and a half, I said, there.
Best wishes, please.
I will.
That
I
she
will.
Hopefully gets better.
Thanks, Eric. It was nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too. Good luck.
Thanks.
Local law that regulates health education practice, like the medicine, nursing,
to have in order to approve the test. That is not that they might not approve the test because of the content, it's because of the language.
Yeah.
So that's one of the issues.
We've had those questions come because there's people in other countries that are interested in using the test.
And although we have a lot of people, not a lot, but because our practice is not that big in Puerto Rico, I would say that probably we have 300 health educators in the US, licensed health educators.
But who licensed
this thing?
Is that the health department?
Yeah. It's like physicians.
Huh.
Yeah. We have to have plans, and we have all the regulations for continuing education.
So interesting.
It is, like for me, I have the local license, but I'm also Chinese. So for me, I have to triple the continuing education because I have to continue chess. Well, the local.
Can you not double up to do some kind of spell?
Well, it is possible. Because chess, because I'm out of the mainland, count everything as category one. So that makes it easier for me. And because I'm looking at the school and teaching, that they have some. Make sure that
So I just want to, you know, you've seen the slides.
Yes, I did.
Let's talk about the